This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. You've probably heard someone threaten to give you a piece of their mind. And we know they're speaking metaphorically, same as if they said, "You're taking a piece of my heart." Difference is, the heart is something you can locate in your body and, if you are so inclined, cut it to pieces. Not so much the mind. And yet a mind is no less real. Without your mind, you wouldn't be able to, among other things, know when someone is speaking metaphorically. So, what is the mind and why do we have one? Psychologist Kurt Gray has co-authored a new book that examines these questions and many, many more. The book is called Mind Club: Who Thinks, What Feels, and Why It Matters. Kurt Gray is also a professor of psychology and neuroscience at UNC Chapel Hill. He's going to be reading tomorrow at MotorCo in Durham, but first joins us in our studio. Kurt, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about this Mind Club. What's the concept here?
So the Mind Club is simply that collection of entities that can think and feel. And, you know, you are presumably in the Mind Club, and so am I. We're having a conversation, and most other people probably are too. But what about things like animals or machines or corporations? Do they belong in the Mind Club with you and me? And how could we ever tell? And if we decided, would anyone else agree with us?
So now what are the foundations, if we take just those examples, what they may have in common and why they may qualify for the Mind Club, what would those entities, animals and corporations, for instance, have in common that could possibly give them anything we would call a mind?
Well, it's an interesting question because animals and corporations are actually seen to have completely different kinds of minds. So animals are seen to be able to feel and sense and have emotions. We care for them. Corporations, totally opposite. We think they can think and intend, and we don't care for them, but we hold them responsible.
And so this question of intention becomes an important part of this analysis of what is a mind, right? And so how do we to tell us about your research. Now, how did you conduct the research? What were the questions you were asking yourself?
So it was a simple study at first. We just wondered, you know, how people see the minds of others. And so we gave them a bunch of different targets, like an adult human, a dog, a baby, a dead person, a vegetative person, and just asked them to rate their mental capacities. And what we thought we'd get is a kind of great chain of being, right? From rocks to plants to animals to people and angels and God. But instead, we got two dimensions, two chains of being, a thinking dimension and a feeling dimension. And these are really two different senses of mind and two different mind clubs.
And how do they distinguish each other? What makes them different?
Well, one is really about kind of the inputs of mind, so sensing and feeling, and the other is about the outputs. But I think what makes them especially different is the moral status we afford to these different mind clubs. Those that feel, we protect, we care about, like little girls and puppies, right? We care about their well-being. Thinkers, on the other hand, like presidents and CEOs, we don't care about harming them as much. We care about if they harm others.
Which gets to something called intent and will, right? The
right.
Idea that you have, and perhaps to some extent, power, the fact that you can do something, have the capacity to think about the consequences, which would mean some sense of modeling a future.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have to be able to do that in order to understand that this act will result in that consequence and all of the collateral, either damage or good things that may follow. And I would hold you responsible. If I thought you could do all of that and then you did the thing,
mm-hmm.
You're a thinking being with a mind and I can either punish you or reward you.
Right. And a big question is who I'm doing that thing towards, right? So if I'm doing that thing towards a feeling, you know, sensing organism, then I'm really a bad person. If I'm doing it to something else, like a mailbox or a piece of wood, then I'm not. And so we talk about in the book how morality is really defined by the pairing of one person's thinking and another person's feeling.
This is something called, or perhaps related to, the perpetrator-victim dichotomy, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the idea there is that we kind of split up the world into perpetrators and victims. So it's hard to see victims as perpetrators. It's hard to see orphans as, you know, doing bad things. And it's hard to see perpetrators as being sensitive to pain. Does Jeffrey Dahmer, you know, does he hurt when he steps on a piece of glass without his socks on? People say, well, not really.
But this also gets to some, I think, fundamental concept or perhaps definition or marker of the mind, and that is the ability to feel a compassion, to have any sense of what another being might be going through. Me knowing what you're going through, either sensing your pain or somehow having an idea what your motives were, right? I can get into your head and know really what you were thinking. That capability is sort of crucial in this dichotomy, in this equation.
Certainly. So, I mean, empathy, right, is the basis of our moral lives, but empathy really depends on just even recognizing that another person has a mind. And so with the recent issues with the Syrian refugees, right, it's very easy to assume that someone who looks different from you and lives far away doesn't have the same kind of mind. And it's very hard to put ourselves in their shoes and appreciate their minds.
Well, and this gets to the question of self. And I think the sort of this wonderful capacity of mind to identify with any kind of cultural entity. I'm an American. I'm a North Carolinian. Mm-hmm. I'm white. I'm an old guy, you know, and I can identify with those things. That's okay for me, but then there are ways in which you can marshal that identity into groupthink and get me to maybe think a little less, because our group, the us, is under assault by the them, which we've defined as not looking like us or something.
Right. So certainly it seems that when you're placed in these kind of us versus them situations, you kind of give up your mind to the group. You lose it in some sense to do the will of the group. But one interesting thing we talk about is really minds are a product of groups in some sense. So if you think of your brain, we're going to get a little philosophical, I guess. If you think of your brain, it's really just a collection, a group of mindless neurons. But together, it makes a mind. So groups are both mindless and the source of our minds.
Which gets us to the heart-mind analogy that I made in the introduction. There is certainly something very physical, neurobiological, that isn't supernatural, the fact that there is a mind. And yet, it's not a thing you can locate. There's not a mind lobe of the brain.
Exactly. So one metaphor that a philosopher named Dan Dennett uses is a center of gravity. So if you've got a piece of wood, it has a center of gravity that you can balance the piece of wood on. But you could, if you dug into it, you'd never find that thing. It's not a thing. It's a construction.
And the materiality of it is crucial. So you talk about the importance of our body, the fact that we identify with the body. And when we think about our mind and other people's minds, it's so closely associated with the thing we call the body, right?
It is. Although a funny thing is that people are dualists, right? So they understand that the mind is in the body, but they very easily can understand that the mind leaves the body. It can switch bodies, right? It can survive after the death of the body and so forth.
And the implications of that are interesting, and the thought experiments you talk about in the book, too. Let's change minds and talk about a guy who's, you know, the married man and the unmarried man, and they switch bodies, and one of them is unfaithful, and what happens when the body of the married man finds itself inhabited by the mind of the single man,
right,
who committed the crime here, right?
Right.
Well, and talk about the value of those thought experiments and what they can tell us if we think those through, what they tell us about our concept of the mind.
So they tell us that, well, it's kind of crazy if you think about it, right? If you had to describe this to an alien, I mean, even just you kind of describe it to me, it's like very complicated, right? Like this person switches minds, it's a crazy thing, but we can all totally appreciate it. We've all seen the Freaky Friday or whatever, and it's very easy for us to imagine minds leaving the body or, you know, going somewhere where we dream or when we die. And I think what that suggests is that we really associate the self with the mind and not the body, and that the mind and the body can be split very easily.
And the religious mind has no trouble with this at all. So for those who believe in an afterlife, there is the assumption that I in my consciousness will recognize they in their consciousness who were my parents, my loved ones. We will maintain our sense of history, our memory of ourselves in a completely different form or a formless state, but keep our memories and our sense of self.
Yeah, and I think even folks who are non-religious still believe that the mind persists somewhere. I think one way of doing it, and so my co-author on this book, he passed away a couple years ago, and his mind still lives on in some ways through the book, but also in my mind, right? So we kind of make facsimiles of other minds within our own minds, and in some ways they can live on as, I think, what would Dan Wegner do, right?
Well, but this also brings us to the distinction between a mind that has lost the life, it's no longer alive, the body is gone, versus a person in a vegetative state.
Mm-hmm.
In both cases, we think the mind doesn't function the way we expect it to. But you suggest that there's a very different way in which we think about the vegetative mind versus the mind of the deceased.
Our research suggests something very crazy, in fact, that people see the dead as having more mind than someone who's in a vegetative state. And, you know, listeners would say, of course, that's not true because you can compare them. One's alive, one's functioning, and one is clearly gone. But if you think about it, someone who passes away, their mind is free to roam in heaven or be around me. My grandfather wants me to get tenure. But someone in a vegetative state doesn't seem to want any of these things because all we see is their body.
So because we're looking at their body, we're not imagining these whatever afterlife or other conditions that they might find themselves floating through. So that has to do with our sense of their mind. And also, there's a fascinating part in this book, a conspiracy theory that you reference involving the Denver airport and a group of reptilian people.
Yes.
Please, right. Tell us more.
So this is a surprisingly high number. 4% of all Americans believe that there is a group of creatures called the reptilians, who are like humans but look like reptiles, and they are running the New World Order, and their home base is under the Denver airport, which some people think is too big to justify itself in some sense. And the reason that these conspiracies are so compelling is because whenever bad things happen in the world, we automatically look to find someone to blame, and the kind of shadowier and bigger the group, the easier it is for us to blame them.
So cause and effect is an important part of human construction, right? This is how we construct our reality. You do this and then that, which is also our sense of time. It goes in a kind of a nice, neat order.
Right.
We actually have some physics now that overthrows some of those concepts, right? That time really might not be as orderly as we think. But it is interesting that we have framed a mind based on our sense of time that creates this image of cause and effect. And then, as you suggest, if we can't get the reason, we'll just make one up.
Right. And it's not just a kind of mechanical cause and effect, but really a mental cause and effect. Right. When bad things happen, we don't just say, well, something bad caused it, something random. We think someone intended it, going back to intention. Someone intended this bad thing, and that's why I'm suffering.
And what about, I mean, politically, this, of course, has implications, this idea that we can identify with a certain group. And you even talk about the fact, if I can conjure up a horrible image, something that will happen to a child, HB2 comes to mind. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have 202 cities across the country that have had these laws on the books for years. And the horrible things that the supporters have said would happen have not happened there.
Mm-hmm.
You can say that. You can put that in the paper. You can report on Salt Lake City. No such crime. Peoria, Illinois. No such crime. You can go to 202 cities. It hasn't happened. But once I say your child could have this horrible thing happen, I can't get that out of my head no matter what the facts do. What's that? What is that thing that allows the visual of the unexplored and unexperienced thing, mm-hmm. the imagination of a thing, Trump, you'll pardon the expression, the fact?
Well, I mean, that's at the crux of mind perception, right, which is what the whole book's about, the fact that we can envision a mind and perceive a mind that maybe isn't really there, or we can fail to perceive a mind in the case, you know, when we deny minds to Muslims, for instance, right, we think they're terrorists, that actually are there. And so I think with HB2, I think what's happening is, you know, people indelibly link moral judgments to perceptions of harm, and they just can't help but see what they see as immoral as harmful. We're just built that way.
But there are times when fact does triumph over perception. I'm thinking of here, this would be common sense for anybody. I wake up in the morning, the sun is in the east. Mm-hmm. I'm standing on a flat piece of ground. I go to bed or have dinner at night, the sun is in the west. I have felt no motion. The sun is moving across the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Common sense. I mean, come on now. It's right. Common sense. Then some guy went to school. He asked some critical questions about that common sense. A few people with a deeper kind of curiosity said, you know, I'm going to run some experiments. I'm not sure that's really what's happening. And we now know, and it is our common sense now based on common knowledge, that, in fact, the Earth is moving. The Earth goes around the sun. We don't experience that. We still don't experience the Earth as moving, as spinning, as going around the sun. And yet we all know from the age of six. How were those facts able to sort of overcome our common experience?
So I think those facts are about things we don't really care a lot about. Everyday kind of reality doesn't make a difference whether I'm moving or the sun's moving. I just have to know that at the end of the day, the sun's going to slip below the horizon. But with things like morality, they matter a lot to everyday life. And even with the sun, I think there's some work out there with everyday physics. even with a lifetime experiencing things dropping to the ground in gravity, people are terrible at understanding kind of how things fall from a cliff. They're just terrible. And so if they're terrible with physics they see every day, they're certainly going to be terrible with something that's ambiguous like morality.
Well, and we still use the term sunrise, sunset, and all of those terms. So our actual common experience of it is the sun is moving, right? I mean, we can't – so you're right. I mean, we don't really fully grasp it. I'm talking today with psychologist Kurt Gray from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He has co-authored a book called The Mind Club, and we're talking about it today on The State of Things. Kurt, there's a story about a man who slept walk. It's kind of a tragic story, but tell us about this. And again, I think this gets at sort of what the mind is and how mutable it is.
So the man's name was Kenneth Parks, and he was a man who lived in Toronto. He, at 21, had a young baby and a new wife, and he fell asleep one night watching television on the couch. He got up from the couch. And notice I didn't say wake up. He was still asleep. He got up. He drove 20 minutes to his in-law's house. He bludgeoned his mother-in-law to death with a tire iron, and then he drove to the police station and said, "I think I just committed a murder." He was asleep during that entire thing. And you'd think he was just making an excuse up, but six sleep experts testified independently that he was asleep. And so he was acquitted of the crime and given some medicine and never raised a hand again. But what this suggests is how little we know our own mind, and that each one of us, you know, given the right disordered sleep patterns, could be a murderer.
Well, and also, I mean, if you think about dreams in general, the fact that we accept as absolutely real what's happening in the time of the dream, we never question it, or rarely do, the reality of the situation, and yet it's thoroughly defies our ordinarily. I mean, many dreams defy our sense of physics. We fly, we do all kinds of crazy things, and never question it. And so, again, it does suggest that the mind sequesters itself from parts of itself, right?
Certainly, and I think. Right. So in one case, that example is really just acting out this terrible dream that often we all have. And another way that it's sequestered is sequestered from our own knowledge of ourselves. Right. We're very poor at knowing our own minds.
But no, I actually told a joke in a dream. Someone told me a joke in a dream. And in the dream, I say, "I don't get it." And I woke up and 3 hours later, I got the joke. I made that joke up, right? I mean,
right.
That came from my head.
Right.
The dream Frank didn't get it, and it took 3 hours for the real Frank to get it.
Was it a funny joke?
It was terrible. That's maybe why I disavowed it.
Right.
But the fact is, it really struck me. I froze in my tracks when I thought about the fact that one head could create a situation in which part of the head didn't know what it was doing.
I mean, some would argue, many psychologists would argue, that's what happens every day with our actions, that they actually bubble up out of our unconscious, and then our conscious self simply gets a sense of ownership. So with speaking, for instance, people almost never know what they're going to say before they say it, right, before it comes out of their mouth. And so it's not surprising the same is true with dreams or whatnot.
Often I don't know what I've said after I've said it. That's the other part of that. Does this have implications going down the line? And if we think about advances in neurobiology as well, implications for the criminal justice system that bases so much of crime and punishment on intent and how we think we can determine intent?
So I think yes and no. There's a great article on this by Josh Green that says, for the law, neuroscience changes everything and nothing. So in some sense, it changes nothing because we all have a sense of which actions are more free or less free. If someone's holding a gun to your head and you do something, clearly that's less free. On the other hand, I think a new understanding of neuroscience doesn't support the idea of like ultimate desert, right? It's not like you're a bad soul that deserves to go to hell, but you just have a bad brain.
But then the implications for punishment, I mean, there are societies in the world that say, we don't care about intent. My cow fell in your ditch. Give me a cow, you know. And once that happens, peace has been restored. The community is at peace. And we're not really asking whether or not you should have dug the pit or I should have known about the pit. That doesn't matter. My cow died in your land. Give me a cow.
Right. So that's fine with cows, which we can replace, right? And we can get recompense. But what about capital punishment, right? You can never replace the loss of a child from someone who murdered them. But like, should you kill them? I'm not sure.
All of these questions will be probed at Motorco tomorrow, but I'm grateful to Kurt Gray for talking with us today about his book, Mind Club, Who Thinks, What Feels, and Why It Matters. Going to be reading tomorrow at 7 at Motorco in Durham. It's part of the Periodic Tables series, and we'll have all that information at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you, Kurt. Good to talk with you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, we're going to look at the foster care system and talk with Ashley Rhodes Cortere, who spent 10 years in the system and went on to become a foster parent herself. We'll do it on the State of Things. Please stay tuned.